Idaho Fish and Game might say, well, you have access, and you might go, no, I don't. So it can get pretty complex because everybody thinks of access in a lot of different ways. And so I have one of my PhD students working on this project with me and with Idaho Fish and Game, trying to dig into that complexity. That way we can give managers at Idaho Fish and Game a little bit more clearer picture of what access means to people, so that way they can better understand why people may or may not be satisfied with it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. My name is Lee Cooper, and I am your host for today. I'm a science writer and editor here at University of Idaho, and I am here with my co-host, Kyle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kyle Fonensteel. I'm Media Relations Manager at U of I.
All right. How's it going today, Kyle?
Great. How about you?
Not too bad. Getting a little tired of the snow, but hopefully we'll be out of that soon. Speaking of the outdoors, that is what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about being outdoors on the public lands in Idaho and how decisions by natural resource managers can affect our enjoyment of our experiences on these lands. So my question for today, Kyle, do you spend any time hiking or hunting or fishing or playing on our public lands at all?
Yeah, I occasionally go on hikes and camping trips on public lands around Idaho, visiting some hot springs, but most of the time I'm riding my bike on public, county, or city paved roads, or on mountain bike trails.
All right, so the times that you do spend out on the land, maybe doing some hiking or camping, outside of things like weather and things like that, what adds to a good experience or a bad experience when you're outside?
Honestly, the most consistent issue I run into, and it isn't even that frequent, is poorly maintained, rough, knotty, or kind of unkempt trails. I guess what I'm specifically thinking of is when the dirt trails are really clumpy and hard to ride on. And I know a lot of that is caused by rain and grazing animals, but it's also caused by people riding the trails really hard or there not being enough maintenance.
Okay. I just came back from Arizona where actually we had trouble finding parking spots at hiking. So there's like too many people, at least, you know, in reference to how many people I wanted there. So for me, that's one of the things that has come up recently. So those are the types of things that we are going to talk about with Kenny Wallen, who is an assistant professor of human dimensions in the Department of Natural Resources and Society. And he's going to talk us through what that means as well. So we're going to end up talking with him about what it's like to manage natural resources and how he learns about what the public feels about that. Ready to dive in?
Okay.
Hi, Kenny. Thank you so much for coming on The Vandal Theory.
Hey, Lee. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. I'm terribly interested in this topic. So first off, can you just introduce yourself to everybody?
Yeah. Hey, everybody. My name's Kenny Wallen. Right now, I'm an assistant professor in our Natural Resources and Society department in the College of Natural Resources. And my work focuses on the human dimensions of fish and wildlife.
Excellent. So let's start just with you're a human dimension scientist. That might not be a term that everybody knows. So can you break that down for me? What does that mean in terms of working in natural resources?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways to think about it. One way to think about it is, you know, when we're dealing with fish and wildlife, for example, we oftentimes think about just the wildlife species or the fish species and the habitats, and then we forget that there's this human component. So there's this triad of habitat and species and then the people, because people, you know, make decisions about how to manage those species and habitats, and then people want to use those species and habitats in certain ways. So we have to account for, you know, people's opinions, their values and preferences when it comes to, you know, especially in my field, fish and wildlife management. And then there's sort of the broader idea that everything we do related to nature and natural resources has some type of human component, right? We're affecting nature, we're interacting with nature, we're using resources, but then those resources affect us. They affect how we, you know, interact with ourselves and with nature. So there's that higher level too, where we're thinking about kind of that human nature relationship. But in general, People and nature are not separate entities, so having that human dimension focus to sort of orient how we start thinking about natural resources is really important. So people are part of the problems and solutions to natural resources.
So my background is in ecology and natural resources and environmental sciences, and this was a new term for me. Has it always been around, or how did it get started?
Yeah, a lot of the ways that it got started was that managers on the ground were seeing problems that they couldn't deal with from that ecological perspective or that biological perspective. They were often, you know, surprised when people didn't like the way that they were managing something, or that people were causing management issues and they didn't know how to deal with those types of behaviors or actions. So they didn't really have a skill set to deal with human behavior, to deal with, you know, human cognition, how people want things managed, those preferences, those values, and more importantly, those behaviors that, you know, we are sometimes asking people to do or not to do in natural resource settings, whether it's to, you know, at an industrial level, not to pollute, or at a very sort of, you know, individual level, you know, not to litter in a national park. There are also, you know, different sorts of disciplines and fields that were interested in just how people interact with their environment, like human ecology started in the early 1900s to think about how people interact with their environments in urban areas. And then rural sociology developed to understand how farmers were interacting with the environment as well. So there's those two different levels where there's this very sort of practical side of human dimensions, and it emerged from there. And then there's this other side where it's very sort of maybe academic, and we might call that like environmental social science. But at the end of the day, they're both pretty much the same thing. We know that people are part of natural resource systems, so we need, you know, scientists and we need practitioners who can deal with the people side of things.
Tell me a little bit more about you. You actually are half-time here at University of Idaho, but you're also half-time with Idaho Fish and Game. So can you tell me what that job is? What do you do for them?
Yeah, so I'm 50-50 between the university and the state agency, and part of that was to increase the capacity of Idaho Fish and Game to be able to do some of this human dimensions work specific to wildlife and fish species. And, you know, most of the time my job deals with a lot of questions about hunters and anglers and what they want or what they prefer or what they don't like, you know, how they want Idaho Fish and Game to manage certain resources this way or that way, or how to set season regulations. Some of the other stuff that I do is more sort of nuts and bolts management. So I help a lot on management plans. So in Idaho, every species has a state management plan. So we're getting ready to work on the deer and elk management plan. And so what I do for that is I do these big statewide surveys of deer and elk hunters to help understand, you know, their concerns and their sort of, you know, behaviors or things that they've done over the past 5 years or just over the past season when it comes to deer and elk hunting, and what they'd like to see the future management of deer and elk look like. And then within that, there's, you know, specific issues that are part of what I call like statewide priorities. So that's the other facet of my job, is dealing with these statewide priority issues. The issues that we're dealing with in Idaho with our, you know, changing demographics is crowding. So that's a big one that comes up for deer and elk hunting. Deer and elk hunters think that there's too many people in certain places around the state. And so my job is to assess that and really give Idaho Fish and Game some nice sort of concrete empirical data to make informed management decisions. Other things are a bit more regional. Well, I do a lot of regional work. So for example, right now I'm getting ready to start a project down in southeast Idaho to look at cutthroat trout conservation and the relationship between cutthroat trout anglers and rainbow trout anglers, and some of the incentives that we want to put on the landscape for anglers to help us manage rainbow trouts, which can hybridize and outcompete the native cutthroat trouts. So that's an example of some of the regional work. And I've done similar regional work with fisheries here in the Clearwater, down with Steelhead and Chinook down in Lewiston and on the middle fork of the Clearwater.
That one's interesting to me just because it's not just Fish and Game making decisions and, you know, doing something on the landscape. It's you're actually working with the people actually out there fishing, right, on that one?
Yeah. Yeah, we do a lot of, like, when people hear about human dimensions, they oftentimes think about, like, surveys, like hunter and angler surveys. But we actually do a lot of on-the-ground work where we go and talk to anglers when they're out fishing, when they're, you know, putting boats in the water and things like that. And we actually do, you know, what we call qualitative work. So we're doing interviews or we're doing focus groups. So we call that type of, that's our research side of things. And then we also do some engagement side or public involvement side. So for example, here in the next few weeks, we're all around the state, we're doing season setting meetings. So big game season setting's coming up. So there's going to be meetings in Moscow and Lewiston, for example, where hunters can come and tell IDFG what they want or what some of the issues that they're dealing with. So yeah, so a lot of our stuff is on the ground, talking directly with hunters and anglers, and oftentimes even non-game people who are doing just wildlife viewing or doing like bird watching or things like that as well.
Is it ever hard to get people to talk to you, to give you their opinions, or is it like almost way too many opinions? There, you get all of them. Everybody's talking all at once.
Yeah, I think most people can relate to the idea that everyone has an opinion and they're happy to tell you what it is. And that is a lot of what my job is dealing with the types of opinions and preferences that people have. But no, for the most part, people love talking about how they are viewing a natural resource or a species that they want to hunt or just want to exist. So they're happy to tell you about the things that they care about. And in Idaho, you know, most of the state population cares about natural resource issues, whether we're talking about hunters and anglers or whether we're talking about more general sort of conservation, threatened or endangered species. People love talking about that type of stuff. So the only issues that we ever have are going to be more, you know, kind of on the science-y side of it with methods, you know, dealing with people who don't respond to surveys and those types of things. But those types of things are kind of impersonal. When you just get a survey in the mail, it's really easy to ignore. Or if it's in your email inbox, it's really easy to ignore. But when you're actually out in the field and you just go talk to people or you put together what we call a focus group and have a group of people talk about a topic, it's pretty easy to get people talking. And even when you do the public meetings, if you've ever been to a fishing game commission meeting, people have, you know, they go up to the mic and they get to talk for 3 minutes and you always have plenty of people to fill the time for those meetings. So for the most part, yeah, my job isn't necessarily hard. But to your point earlier, yeah, everybody has an opinion. So there's a lots and lots and lots of opinions that I have to sort of filter through and kind of provide some of the commonalities, some of the trends, and some of the sort of conflicting opinions that we have, because you're never going to have a clear understanding from everybody. There's always going to be multiple wants and needs from people that you're going to get when you do human dimensions work. So that's part of my job, is to sort of balance that and give Idaho Fish and Game good data on what people want.
I mean, obviously, you're for these meetings that, at least at the time of that we're recording this, are coming up, are about like setting the season, so kind of like setting rules.
Yeah.
But you also do some, kind of going back to the cutthroat again, where you actually want the people out in the field helping you to a certain extent, correct?
Yeah. When we think about like natural resource management or just wildlife management in general, human dimensions, a lot of what we do is we want to view people as part of that management system, and sometimes they're a management tool. And for this example that we're starting in the South Fork Snake River in southeast Idaho, yeah, we want anglers to be on the ground and going after rainbow trout. We want them harvesting rainbow trout because rainbow trout, they outcompete the native cutthroat trouts. And so we actually need to suppress those rainbow trout numbers. And so we need to keep those rainbow trout numbers down so that they don't hybridize or outcompete the native cutthroat trout. But the trick is, anglers want to get rainbow trout and they want to get cutthroat trout, but we have to figure out a balance between the catch and harvest of rainbow trout and the catch and release of native cutthroat trout. We want people to do more rainbow trout fishing so that Idaho Fish and Game doesn't have to do, in this context, what is somewhat controversial, which is electrofishing, which is shocking fish and removing them from the system. We would rather have anglers do that. but we're trying to figure out ways to incentivize anglers to do that for us. It's an interesting system to work in that particular studies.
I was going to make some sort of dad joke about a fishy situation, but I'm going to let it go.
I think there's plenty of opportunities for fish puns when that comes up. We'll see how many we can fit into the report that we give to Idaho Fish and Game. So it's always nice to laugh when you are dealing with some of these, you know, pretty intense issues. So because in that area you have a lot of very high profile anglers. It's a well known reach of that Snake River that a lot of people come into Idaho, non-residents come into Idaho to go specifically fish for cutthroat trout in that system. So it's really important to Idaho. It's really important to Idaho Fish and Game. But balancing cutthroats and rainbows and having anglers do some of the management for us is really important. So we're just trying to figure that out right now.
Well, so talking about a balancing act, one of the things I'd love to do is kind of walk through an example of what might appear on the onset as a relatively simple question, but actually, once you start thinking about it, can become incredibly complex. During a previous conversation we had, we started talking about how complex the question of, are hunters satisfied with access to land in Idaho? Which it seems like, well, yes or no. But in fact, it becomes incredibly difficult. So can you start, give me some examples of what goes in to that question once people start talking about whether they're satisfied or not?
Yeah, in the human dimensions world, like that's a basic question that we ask a lot of times, like satisfaction questions. So in this case, yeah, we wanted to know, are, you know, hunters and anglers satisfied with access in Idaho? We've got, you know, over 70% of land in Idaho is public land. So on the face, it should be satisfaction because there's so much public land to go do the things that they want to do. But when we started asking that question, you know, my job is to sort of think a little bit more about that. And so we had to start thinking a little bit deeper that maybe Idaho Fish and Game's definition of access was different than hunters and anglers' definitions of access. We start looking into the literature and the research on access. And there's a whole bunch of research that says access is what we call multidimensional. So it has multiple definitions. One person can have this definition of access and be completely satisfied with it. And another person can have another definition of access and then be completely dissatisfied with it. Someone can think of access as the public land that is close to home where they can go hunt during the season when they want to. So to them, their access is good, because it's nearby. So it's kind of this physical access, this proximate access, if you will. And then other people think of access as access to high quality places where they can go do the thing that they want to do, where they can go experience it the way they want to experience it. So they're looking for access to places maybe where there aren't so many people, where there is good game out there for them to hunt. And they might view the public lands, even though there's, you know, 3/4 of the state is public lands, they might view those as low quality places and have a low satisfaction of tolerance because they don't think that they have access to the right places. And then in between that, there's a whole bunch of differentiation that can be made, because you talk about public land and then we can talk about private land and access to private land. And then you start talking about differences between people who are older and younger when you talk about physical barriers to access as well. It's really interesting. And then there's, you know, the things like regulations, because that's a lot of what we do, is we regulate access to places through our hunting season. So during the time that you might want to go hunt some species, elk, deer, whatever it is, the time that you have off from work or the time that you wanted to go do it, that season might in that particular region might not be accessible to you because it's, you know, 2 weeks later. But there's access, you know, 6 hours away and still in the state. Idaho Fish and Game might say, well, you have access, and you might go, no, I don't. So it can get pretty complex because everybody thinks of access in a lot of different ways. And so I have one of my PhD students working on this project with me and with Idaho Fish and Game, trying to dig into that complexity. That way we can give managers at Idaho Fish and Game a little bit more clearer picture of what access means to people. So that way they can better understand why people may or may not be satisfied with it.
Yeah, I mean, while you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, and like, Are the roads good? Can I get my personal car in? Is the boat launch available? Or do I need a four-wheel drive vehicle to get to it? Like, there could be just so many little things that would suddenly make me jump from, oh yeah, I've got access, to, nope, not satisfied.
Yeah, it's really interesting, especially when you think about a lot of Idaho fishing games. Management is going to be on shared lands with federal lands or with timber industry and things like that, or private landowners through the Access Yes program. They have to do a lot of management just between the different types of property ownerships, and then they have to manage for how people think of that access as well. So there's a lot of variation to what access is across the state, and it's a pretty complex issue.
So while you're out doing your surveys and talking with people and everything, have you ever been surprised by anything you've learned during your work?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, sometimes surprises happen in research when you're dealing with some of the dark side of wildlife management. Part of my research that isn't associated with Idaho Fish and Game is dealing with raptor conservation. And we have a Golden Eagle project that's going on across the Intermountain West, so from Arizona on up to Montana. And we're interviewing landowners and ranchers about Golden Eagle persecution, or people who shoot Golden Eagles, basically, because they think that they're a nuisance species, or they think that they're eating their calves or lambs. So when you have your cattle ranchers and your sheep ranchers are the primary rancher populations that we're talking to. And so we're trying to understand sort of the motivations. Why do people shoot or trap or poison Golden Eagles? Because if everybody doesn't know, they're federally protected. So it's a felony to do anything with any type of migratory bird, but raptors in particular. But we want to understand that. Like, why do people shoot raptors? And so you might sort of think that some people are going to sort of beat around the bush or not give you a straight answer because you're talking about basically an illegal behavior. But what we're finding is that a lot of times ranchers, landowners, or whomever else that we're talking with is happy to tell us about why they have shot a Golden Eagle, or why they, or somebody that they know has shot a Golden Eagle. It surprises me that people are willing to provide that information, because you might otherwise think that they're not going to tell you about it, which is essentially a crime that they've committed. So it's quite interesting. But that's the kind of information that we need, because we can't inform management if we don't know why. So that's one of the big things that Human Dimensions can do, is answer that question of why people do certain behaviors, whether it's related to hunting and fishing or whether it's related to wildlife conservation or threatened and endangered species. But yeah, getting people to actually talk about the details of committing a crime against a Golden Eagle or a bald eagle or whatever other type of raptor it is, it's been a very surprising and a good thing for us, because we're getting really, really good, high quality information.
I wouldn't have guessed that. Well, we're getting on towards the end here. Is there any kind of last thing you want to leave with people?
Yeah, what I would say to everyone is, you know, people are part of the landscape. They're part of these natural resource management systems. And so considering that we have a big, big effect and impact on our natural resource systems, I want just people to start thinking about that. I want people to start thinking about, oh, what is it that people are doing, or how can people behave differently? And just making sure that they're adding that people part to when they're thinking about species or habitat, they're also thinking about people, right? Because the way I always phrase it is, we affect natural resources and natural resources affect us. So we're in it together. And any problem that you want to solve in natural resource management or conservation is going to start with people. And that's really the big message to get across. And then if there's anybody out there from state or federal agencies, just hire more of us. So you need more than one of us at your state agency, if you even have one. So we're very limited in who hires us. But so I need all the states to hire like 10 of us.
Well, hopefully they all listen to the podcast and we'll get right on that.
Yes. Tell all the governors.
All right. Thanks, Kenny, for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. So what'd you learn? What did you think?
It was really interesting to hear about how he talked about human dimensions and how these researchers view people as part of the land management system. I always really love to hear how researchers and public officials really embrace the public's opinion in their work. It's refreshing and important to maintain the public's trust because, you know, once it breaks down, you're fresh trout of luck.
That was terrible. Terrible! You're fired.
There was talk about fish puns. I had to see what I could come up with.
Yeah, no, I think for me it was, it makes a lot of sense. My background is in the sciences, in, you know, ecology, and there was no point in our training where we learned how to talk to people and do the research that involves focus groups and things like that. That was not in our training whatsoever. So it makes sense to me that you would have to bring in somebody who is an expert in understanding, you know, opinions and drawing out conclusions, and, you know, not just giving in to the squeaky wheel. Definitely you'd have to bring in a human dimension scientist. So it was just something like, oh yeah, that seems obvious if I had ever thought of that.
Yeah, I like embracing that there are experts in understanding public opinion, because on its surface it can seem really messy, but what I really like about especially qualitative research is that they're able to pull apart commonalities in how people feel and the ways they talk and frame issues and help us make sense of things.
Absolutely. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu/vandaltheory, to learn more about our research. And you can email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu if you have questions or comments. Please take a look on any and all of the podcast platforms. We're pretty much on all of them. Rate and review us, and absolutely subscribe. My name is Lee Cooper.
And I'm Kyle Fawnensteel.
Thanks, everyone.